good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about distributed systems by looking at this idea of a network file system, that we wanted multiple machines to share the same files. And a way we could achieve that using the client-server model is by having a server for those files. And rather than accessing a local file system, we'd access a remote file system. And we got built that using remote procedure calls. But we saw that we had some choices in designing the protocol for that, where we wanted to make considerations about having an interface that makes it more convenient for the servers and or clients. And a key choice we had there was whether the server would be stateless or stateful. So when we say a server is stateless, we mean the server isn't remembering things about the clients between its requests. So for example, we said in our stateless network file system protocol, we'd want to have the clients remember everything about file descriptors and what files applications have open. So the servers wouldn't have to remember that. And this made some things easier, like, you know, handling failure. Like when a client went away, the server didn't need to actually track that sort of information. If the server crashed, we just cared about the data in the file system. We didn't need to have some extra data that we needed to restore in order to make clients not all need to be rebooted. We also saw this general pattern, which is useful in a lot of other problems, for taking something that's stateful, where we're having the server do a lot of work and it's kind of complicated, and making it stateless, which is that we can send to the client the info to send with the next request, rather than storing that on the server. That even though the client might not understand or care about specifically about what that information is for, we can still have the client do the job of storing it, and that's often much more convenient for implementing the server, especially if we want to handle failures kind of elegantly. We also saw that there were some trade-offs, and for the network file system, this really occurred with caching. That if we were stateless, if we aren't remembering anything about what the clients are doing in between their requests, then the clients can't usefully cache something and expect to know if the value they have cached is invalid. And one solution to this, that is a real solution, is that we can say, well, that's really not worth it, and use a more stateful protocol. Now, some systems do that. If we want to keep things stateless, we have to make some sort of compromise, because it's not going to be practical to cache if we still have to check with the server every time. It's mostly going to defeat the point of caching. Yeah, we'll send less stuff over the network, but most of our cost of caching, especially for small files, is that we have to talk to the server at all, not that we have to send, get back, you know, a couple bytes from the server saying nothing's changed versus the whole kilobyte file. And in NFS version 3, they have this compromise where they check the cache is validity and open and update the server on close. And the idea here is this is okay if no two clients open are accessing the file, accessing, you know, keeping open the file at the same time. Once. Even though this gets rid of the sort of our notion of transparency, that if in cases where two clients have the file open at the same time, they're really going to notice that this is not like a local file system. That was on distributed systems. And our topic after that was a bit about security. And to introduce that, I introduced this idea of protection, our main thing we're concerned about, which is mechanisms for controlling access to resources generally, and mention that we're going to achieve security, sort of that we have some goals about what things can happen that we're going to hopefully achieve with these protection mechanisms. And in this class, we're primarily concerned with what mechanisms can we provide. And the goal is that system administrators and standard programs can configure these mechanisms to achieve actual security goals. And our sort of general idea for controlling access to resources is that we need to specify what things can access the resource. And our key way of doing this was an access control list, where there the idea is we have a resource like a file or a process, and alongside it we'd store what things are allowed to access it. And our typical notion is that for a file, like these things, which would actually be processes trying to access the file, would have some correlation to like people. And we needed some way of representing that and concretely representing these lists of who can do what with each resource. So, you know, these lists were basically, you know, someone and operations and a list of different someones and what operations they could perform in that resource. And we saw that, like, we had various forms we might store this, but that was the key idea. And what were these someones? And in the sort of POSIX model, we had two ways of representing that. We'd have these user IDs and these group IDs. And conceptually, you know, these could correspond to users and groups of people, though that's not required. And these IDs would just be numbers. So from the kernel's perspective, it doesn't actually care if the user ID or the group ID is a person or a group of people. It just stores a number in the process control block. And these are used on syscall entry. So like when we do an open or a rename or kill or so on, versus the to check the access control list. So these were how we would identify things in the access control list. And we'd store these in the process control block to know what the current process is allowed to do with each resource. So these would just be IDs, and they'd be set by some other programs that would handle things like authentication, namely like passwords and so on, would set these for the kernel. Now, we couldn't just allow any program to set these user IDs, and we needed some way of setting up that sort of those sort of initial states. When I log into the system, how do the user IDs of my programs get set? And to help support this, we have this idea of a super user, that there'd be a special user ID that bypasses most security checks. In POSIX, this is UID 0, just arbitrary choice. And we run the initial program with that user ID. It would figure out things like what password and user ID I entered in, and then set a different user ID. And because of this, we don't have to have every program be able to choose any user ID. We didn't have to have the kernel need to worry about how do I verify a password. You know, that would all be handled by this, you know, initial program that ran with these extra privileges. Now, we saw that we had cases where we still wanted me to be logged in as, you know, my user ID, but I wanted to do operations that normally my user ID couldn't do. So one example we saw was sudo. We had other examples, like I want to mount USB sticks, and often we don't code into the kernel, you know, really good rules about what's the difference between mounting the USB stick and mounting, you know, say, the disk in a way which lets me damage its file. So we had this idea where we could provide controlled access to super user functionality so we could implement programs like sudo or that mount a USB stick program where the system administrator would set up some application that did something that required extra privileges like change to a different user, reboot the system, mount that USB stick, and they'd write this program that would do that. They'd set this special bit in the file system to say, this program is special and should run with extra privileges. And because they controlled what that program could do, this wouldn't let me do anything I wanted. It would just let me do what that program let me do. And this would be a way of adding sort of functionality, you know, that I could do in spite of my user ID being set, quote unquote, wrong, without modifying the kernel to add all these cases. Now, we saw that those user ID programs were a very flexible mechanism. They let us you know, incorporate a lot of functionality that, you know, would have been hard to encode in the kernel, they're also pretty error-prone. And the biggest issue is that I need to write my set user ID application very carefully because it can be run in really strange ways. And despite that, I need it to not do things that the user is not supposed to be able to do. And we saw one very common type of problem you get when writing programs like this, and we gave the example for set user ID applications, but it occurs elsewhere, of time to check to time of use vulnerabilities. And the idea with this problem is that, you know, one thing we might want to do is like check that a file the user passed in, they're actually allowed to access before doing something privileged with that file, like, for example, printing it out. And we saw that the problem was that when we checked might not be when we actually used the file. And for set user ID programs, we had this nice tool that we could temporarily become the original user to do open, etc. That this would be how we'd avoid it. And this means that, you know, the check would be done when the set UID program accessed the thing, did access. So there'd be no difference between the time of check and the time of use with that solution. And that was sort of a tool we provided. And this was the sort of reason for multiple user IDs. Why, when I introduced the system call to get the effective user ID, why it was called the effective user ID, what are the others? The others are to support this temporary switching. So before I move on, I'm going to have one more topic about security. And I'm going to talk briefly about virtual machines. But before I move on, any questions about things we covered last time, either the network file system topics or about the security and access control list topics? Okay, so as I said, one last security topic. So what we've seen so far with access control list is something sometimes called ambient authority, that sort of in the air around the code that's executing, you have a user and group ID that determine what you can do. So we have, you know, we have one way of specifying the thing we want, the file we want to read, or say a process we want to kill, and a different mechanism is used to determine how, whether or not we can do that. So the permission information is kind of on the side. And, you know, when we do our open operation, we aren't specifying whether or not we can do that explicitly. That's kind of implicit, kind of ambient. It's just in the air around our process. So there's an alternate approach that some OSs really like, where instead of having this sort of as an on-the-side information, we couple the ability to specify what file I'm referring to or what process I'm referring to with permission to access the thing. So in this model, you know, rather than using something like a file name, we're going to have some token that identifies what file we want to access. Typically, it's going to be OPEG, and that's going to give us permission to access it. And you might say, like, why would we want to do this? Why do we want to get rid of file names? And the big benefit of this approach is the check for what thing are we accessing is the can we access it check. They're the same check, and this means that we're doing sort of less steps to access the thing. And importantly, from a security point of view, this hopefully makes it less likely that we'll have bugs where we forget to do checks or do checks at the wrong time. You know, it's one of those time to check, time to use problems because of this coupling. On the other hand, we're making this compromise that we're making it maybe harder to identify the things we're accessing. They might say, Like, this seems like a very exotic way of accessing things like files. You know, we've never really done that. But we actually have seen things that are capabilities. So one example of capabilities we've seen are file descriptors. So in the file descriptor, you get a token. You know, our token is the index into the process's file descriptor table. And if it's in the file descriptor table, we can access it. And the key idea is open, you know, checks the permissions to create FD. But once we have an FD, we have a file descriptor, there's no more checking. We just look up, yes, we have that file open, yes, we can access it. So typically we just don't check after that. You know, the file descriptor gives us the ability to access the file, and we know we can access that file because there's a file descriptor for it. And the page table, you can think of the same way. The page table is the list of physical pages you can access, and you have a virtual address you use to index it. If you can't come up with a virtual address, you can't access the page. The processor doesn't do a separate check of, you know, checking your user ID to see if you can access this page. It just knows if it's in the page table, you can access it. If it's not, you can't. So this key idea of this capability is that we're going to store with our process the list of what the process can access. We're not going to do a lookup on the side. And this means that our handle to access things is going to be just a key in that table. There's no way we can accidentally skip the check for permissions. Now, something you might complain about is like, sure, file descriptors are great, you know, virtual addresses are great, but the things I want to do with things like file names, which this doesn't work very well for. Like, if I want to write a file in one process and read it in another, I probably want a file name because how else am I going to tell the other process where the file is? So to make these capabilities useful, we need some functionality which doesn't really exist for these file descriptors or page table entries in POSIX systems. We need ways to share these capabilities between programs. Now, we kind of have this for spawn programs. Like when we fork, we can share file descriptors between a parent and a child process. But often we want to write a file in one process and read it from another, and there's not forking relating them. So another option might be that we could have the ability to send these capabilities over, say, a socket or a pipe that we can send from one process to another. And in Unix, in fact, this is supported for file descriptors. You can actually send a file descriptor from one process to another over a local socket. And this lets you make these capabilities a lot more useful. So you could imagine having a server that you run when you log in, and processes get a file descriptor for that server, and they can ask that server for other file descriptors. So in this way, you can kind of build on top of this capability model things like file names. So you could have that server, you ask for, hey, where's the file that with this name? It gives you a file descriptor for that, but the kernel still just deals with these capabilities, these just tokens which let you access a thing. So questions about sort of our capability idea. So we have this key idea that rather than using sort of file names, process IDs, global identifiers, we're going to use something like file descriptors, you know, where having a file descriptor says, yes, you can access the file, you know, and if you opened it for reading, the file descriptor is marked as available for reading. So all the information is in this sort of table with each process, and we're just providing indices into the table. And to make this useful, we just need a way of sharing these between programs. And we need file descriptors for, you know, every type of resource that we want to do this capability kind of thing for. And to give a concrete example of how this might look, we can look at sort of an old research project from Cambridge, which took a traditional Unix system. They took FreeBSD and they added capabilities to it. And they did this by observing, well, file descriptors are basically capabilities, but they just don't support enough for us to avoid using access control lists. We still need to have file names. We still need to like check process ID when we have process IDs, which we need to do some permissions check when we kill. And they wanted to have the option of having everything use capabilities where you have some file descriptor like handle, and that says that yes, you can, you know, execute something. Yes, you can kill a process. Yes, you can read a file, and so on. And they did this as an opt-in thing because they wanted normal Unix code to work, but they did it by extending file descriptors. So they said, rather than file descriptors just representing files, we'll let them represent directories, processes, everything where we need to do some sort of permissions check. And rather than file descriptors just saying you can read or write something, we'll add extra permissions for new operations, you know, which are, you know, analogous to read or write, but apply because we have extra types of file descriptors. So if you want to execute a program, that's going to be a new type of permission you can have on a file. If you want to open files within a directory, that's going to be a new type of permission you're going to have on that file descriptor that represents a directory. If you have a file descriptor that represents a process, you know, it can be marked as letting you use that to kill the process. And so on. So they just extended file descriptors to point to not just regular files and added extra bits besides can you read or write, which were set when those file descriptors were created. And to support, you know, not doing access control list checks, and they added sort of extra ways of getting new file descriptors and using file descriptors. So for example, given a directory, I want to read files in it. Typically, I do that by taking the path to the directory and appending the file name. But that means now, through that, I'm relying on the access control list for the directory to determine whether or not I'm allowed to do that. If we want to use a capability-based approach, instead, we're going to rely on the fact that I have a file descriptor for that directory, a capability, a token to access the directory, and that's going to be marked as saying, yes, you can open files here. So we needed a new version of open that takes this capability and opens something in the directory. And similarly, for executing something, we need a new version of exec where rather than using a file name and looking up the access control list for that file, we have a file descriptor, which is our token to access the executable, which already says you're allowed to execute it. And from that, you know, we just need a version of exec where we give that instead of an executable name. And though this was a research project, these sorts of extra calls are actually present in many modern Unix systems because this is often a useful model. They also need to do things for example, fork. You need a file descriptor that represents a process, so they added that a variant of the fork system call that returns this sort of file descriptor analog rather than a PID, where the idea is that rather than using a process ID, which is a global thing and doesn't say, you know, given a process ID, can you kill the process? Can you wait for it? They give you this sort of file descriptor analog, which encodes in it that this is the process you're talking about and you can kill it and you can wait for it and so on. So questions about capabilities. So capabilities, yeah. So these are a very attractive mechanism for operating system designers because they simplify sort of the core operating system's code. And with some work, you can provide sort of similar functionality that we've expected with our, you know, traditional access control list on top of this if you really need it. Because you can have like a server that checks access control list and gives out capabilities because we can share them between processes. So our next topic is going to be about virtual machines. And I'm going to be talking about our traditional notion of virtual machines. So if you remember way back when we introduced processes, I mentioned that you can kind of view any operating system as a kind of virtual machine. It's just a question of what's the interface it's providing, where typically operating systems provide what we call a process virtual machine interface, where a lot of things were very different from real physical hardware, where we had things like system calls rather than accessing device controllers, where we had exceptions rather than sort of context switching happening. And we're going to talk about how do we provide a system virtual machine, something which is going to imitate a physical interface, something VirtualBox-like, and so on. So our goal here is to imitate a hardware interface. So one question we're going to have to answer is what hardware? And I'm going to talk about imitating a hardware interface, not necessarily imitating the real hardware interface. Usually, when we're implementing a system virtual machine, we're going to choose some hardware that's easy to emulate that our OS can run on, that the OS we want to run in the virtual machine can use. We're not going to necessarily say, I need to emulate the exact hardware I'm running on. So I'm going to talk a bunch about virtual machines, and we're going to use some terminology. So I'm going to use the term hypervisor or virtual machine monitor to refer to the sort of program that runs system virtual machines. So this is sort of approximately like VirtualBox. And the program that runs within the virtual machine, the operating system I'm running, so I'm going to call the guest OS. So this is the operating system that runs within the virtual machine. And the virtual machine, we're going to say, runs on the host OS. And we're going to kind of, to keep talk about this simpler, we're going to kind of act as if the hypervisor is kind of a part of the host OS. I recognize that when we think about VirtualBox, it's kind of an application on the host OS. We're going to act as if it's integrated into the host OS when talking about how these things are implemented. In practice, when it runs as an application in the host OS, the host OS is going to have to provide some extra functionality that's implemented in the host OS's kernel. You know, like some new system calls and so on to allow the hypervisor to do what it needs to do. So we're just going to kind of pretend or act as if the host OS, you know, integrates the hypervisor. The host OS might also run non-virtual machines, but we're going to act as if it's an OS component, even though in practice the implementation might be sort of partially or mostly outside of the actual host OS kernel. So questions about these terms? It's really important we understand guest OS versus host OS, or else things will be really confusing. Okay. So we have these terms, and I'm going to introduce sort of one way of doing virtualization. And there's a bunch of choices we have that you have to make when we decide about system virtual machines. And I'm going to talk about how to do what's called full virtualization. So we're going to take a guest OS, and we're not going to change it from something that runs on real hardware. So it's going to run without changes as if it's on real hardware. This is not the only thing that system virtual machines do. So sometimes there's something called paravirtualization, where we'll modify the guest OS in small ways to support the virtual machine better. And when we talk about what we need to do for full virtualization, you'll see some reasons why we might want to do that. You'll see things that are kind of awkward, kind of slow, that if we could speed those up, that would probably be great. But when we pair virtualization, this alternative, it does involve changing the guest OS, but applications on the guest OS will still be unchanged. So this is like changing the guest OS kernel, but not guest OS applications. So I'm introducing these terms to give you an idea of where we're standing. So we're in this full virtualization camp. I know that this is a fuzzy line if you're thinking about people using this in industry. So, for example, sometimes you'll have like a custom device driver that only works in virtual machines. For example, rather than talking to a real display, you have a device driver that talks to a virtual display that would not work with any real hardware. Is that per virtualization? Depends who you ask. But sort of the key idea is that, you know, our aim is to potentially support unmodified guest OSs on real hardware. And we're going to talk about one way of doing this. And there are a bunch of variations that I'm not going to talk about, or I won't have time to talk about. And I'm going to briefly mention two of these just so you're aware they exist. So one is that you can have extra hardware support for virtualization. So I'm assuming that our hardware basically wasn't built with virtualization in mind, at least not very much. And we're just going to implement virtual machines despite that. Commonly, you'll have extra hardware support for virtualization. And our discussion of how we're going to implement virtualization without this extra hardware support will give you some ideas about what we would want that support to do. Another option for implementing virtual machines that we aren't going to talk about is that you could compile the guest OS guest's machine code into new machine code. We're going to instead run the guest OS's machine code on the real hardware, but just not in the same mode, not in kernel mode anymore, on the original machine. Like kind of the same way we run an application, on a normal application, we run it on the original hardware. But there's another option for implementing this where we just take the machine code and compile it to new machine code. This sounds really slow, but it's actually often not. But we're not going to talk about that option for implementing things, even though there are real virtual machines which use this sometimes. So in our technique for implementing a virtual machine, we're going to have this conceptual layering. And this is a conceptual layering for the same reason that sort of our equivalent layering of hardware, kernel, application without virtual machines is a conceptual layering. That we know that on a normal OS, when we're running an application, it's really running directly on the hardware, even though we would draw this diagram of it running on top of the kernel, because the kernel is going to handle all the sorts of things the hardware doesn't know what to do. And in the same way, we're going to run the guest OS on top of the hypervisor. And we can think of the guest OS as sort of being a process for the hypervisor, like our application and without virtualization is a process for the kernel. And we're going to run the guest OS in user mode, and we're also going to run the guest OS's programs in user mode. Now, the guest OS has some code that it, when it's running on real hardware, wants to run in kernel mode, and some that it wants to run in user mode. And we want to achieve the sort of property that when the guest OS program that's running program like tries to do something, that it's going to use services from the guest OS, you know, what the guest OS would do in kernel mode. So we're going to have sort of a pretend user mode, a pretend kernel mode, and the hypervisor in a real kernel mode. So from the guest OS's point of view, it's going to think it's in kernel mode sometimes and sometimes in user mode. Actually, it's always in user mode. And the hypervisor's job is going to be to simulate this difference, simulate these pretend kernel modes. Now, as I mentioned, you know, introducing this, sort of this whole thing is like a process. And we're going to track, like we would for a normal process, you know, the state of the process. So what is that state? Well, we have the state we have for any process. We have the registers. When the guest OS is running, it's page table, what things, IO things it can access. This is all stuff we actually have for normal processes. The form might be a little different. Like, we're probably going to represent the list of I/O devices unlike we would for a normal process where it's a list of file descriptors you have open, but this is the same type of information we track for a normal process. Now, because we have this notion of pretend kernel mode, we're going to have to track some extra information to support that. So we're going to have to, for example, keep track of whether the guest OS thinks it's in pretend kernel mode or pretend user mode. We, as the hypervisor implementer, have to track that because the real hardware isn't. The real hardware, it's user mode. We also have to track all the state associated with kernel mode that the guest OS has, like what its page table pointer is, what its exception table pointer is, and so on. Because the hardware version of this is going to be the one for the hypervisor, not for the guest OS. And as we're going to talk about later, we're also going to need some extra data structures to translate from what the pretend kernel mode is doing to something the hardware understands. And we'll look at that later. This is mostly going to come up when we talk about address translation. So the guest OS is kind of like a process, but we're just tracking some extra stuff to support this pretend kernel mode functionality. So that's sort of what we're tracking. Let's think about how do we actually, you know, make it when the guest OS is running in this pretend kernel mode and it tries to do something that it acts like it would on the real hardware. And our big question is like, well, when it tries to do something that a normal OS would do, what's going to happen? And our hope is that when the guest OS does those things, it's going to trigger an exception. So for example, if the guest OS tries to talk to a device, well, we don't allow user mode code to talk directly to devices, so it's going to trigger a fault, some sort of a page fault or a protection fault, depending on how it's trying to talk to the device. If it tries to run a kernel-only instruction like one to disable interrupts, well, we don't allow normal programs to disable interrupts because that would hang the whole system. So since it's running in user mode, that's going to trigger a protection fault. And our hypervisor is going to have an exception handler. And rather than doing what a normal OS would do, if a normal OS got a protection fault because a program was trying to talk directly to devices, it's going to kill the program and say, hey, I have system calls. You should open a file. When the guest OS does it, what we want to do instead is say, talk to the device for the guest OS. You know, we want to translate that into the operation the guest OS was trying to do on real hardware. When the guest OS tries to disable interrupts, in a normal OS, we'd say, hey, don't disable interrupts. That's my job to decide when to do that. When the guest OS does it, we want to say, oh, sure, I've disabled interrupts, but we won't really disable interrupts, but we'll just keep track of that so we won't pretend there's interrupts happening for the guest OS while it has them pretend disabled. So we're going to emulate that interrupt disabling functionality. And for example, if the guest OS makes a system call, we don't want to actually make a real system call. We want to run the guest OS's system call handler because that's what would happen on real hardware. And so this idea of sort of relying on the guest OS triggering exceptions is how we're going to implement most of the functionality of our system virtual machine. That this is how we're going to make our I/O operations work, how we're going to make exceptions work. We're going to have to do something special for handling page tables, and I'll talk about that as our last topic for today. So let's look at these first two things, which were, again, as I said, we're going to rely on things like I/O, kernel mode related instructions like disabling interrupts, setting exception tables. We're going to rely on those trapping. And for making exceptions work, we're going to rely on those also trapping. Trapping, I mean, running an exception handler in the hypervisor. And the key thing is that in that exception handler, our job is not going to be to do what a normal OS would do, but to emulate what hardware would do. So let's think about sort of a privileged instruction, like, you know, accessing device memory. So normally, this would trigger a page fault, and we want to actually pretend it does the right thing, usually. So in our hypervisor, we're going to do the actual privileged operation on behalf of the program. So let's look at how we implement that. And this is assuming that the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode. So the guest OS, it's running in its pretend kernel mode. Remember, there's also a pretend user mode, but it's running in its pretend kernel mode, and it tries to access the device. That's not allowed because on the real hardware, it's in user mode. So this gets a protection fault. And rather than crashing the guest OS, we'll actually talk to the device. And based on talking to the device on behalf of the guest OS, we'll update the guest OS state and switch back to it, have it keep running as if that try to access device actually worked. So one question we might have is like, what does our protection fault handler actually do? How did we figure out, hey, the guest OS is trying to talk to the device, you know, how are we going to figure that out without the hardware helping us out? So sort of our basic idea for what the trap handler is doing to handle this is that when we have this protection fault, we're going to look and see, okay, I had an exception happen. Was the instruction that tried to trigger the exception something that was trying to read from a keyboard? And if so, rather than triggering my crash the guest OS code, let's do the read for the guest OS based on all its registers. And notice that option we have in our hypervisor, which means we don't have to rely on the hardware helping us out very much, is that we can examine the instruction that triggered the protection fault. So even though the hardware might not tell us, hey, your program was trying to read from the keyboard, we can figure that out ourselves based on it being a protection fault and looking at the instruction that failed. To give a concrete example, when XV6 does keyboard IO, it runs this in instruction to read from this special register that has the keyboard data. And this instruction uses register DX as the number for the keyboard register, and AL is the destination. So what we want to do in our protection fault handler is figure out, oh, this is the instruction that ran. It was trying to read from the keyboard register based on its arguments and trying to write to AL. Let me modify AL and then skip to the next instruction and keep writing the guest OS. The guest OS will think that it ran an in instruction and it worked, even though what actually happened is it triggered a protection fault and I had to do a whole bunch of work to pretend it worked. So like a more concrete version of this would be that we'd say, okay, I got an exception that's a protection fault. The guest OS is in kernel mode. Let's look at this. We're going to say, okay, is this the in instruction that I know is used to read from the keyboard? If so, let's figure out what the in instruction's reading from. Oh, it's the keyboard special register for getting the key code. Okay, let's do our read from the keyboard. And this, you know, might be implemented differently. So for example, maybe this reads from an SSH connection. That's fine, but we're going to emulate the read from keyboard operation with whatever our equivalent of a keyboard is, based on detecting that, oh, you were trying to do an in instruction that reads from the keyboard. And then we're going to modify the same things the instruction would modify. So we're going to write to that same destination register and update the program counter to skip ahead to the next instruction, and then return from the protection fault, keep running the guest OS as if everything went great. So questions on sort of this pseudocode for emulating our keyboard read operation. Okay, so something worth noting is that this sort of choice assumes the guest OS is in kernel mode. And the reason we're doing this when the guest OS is in kernel mode is that on a real hardware, in kernel mode, this would really read from the keyboard. if we were in user mode on real hardware, what would happen? Well, we'd trigger a protection fault, just like we did on the real hardware, and we'd end up running an exception handler. But we wouldn't end up running this exception handler. We'd end up running the guest OS's exception handler. So when we have this privilege instruction, we also need to handle the case, what if it happens in user mode, in the pretend user mode? In that case, we want to sort of reflect the exception to the OS that, yes, it ran, you know, our hypervisor, visor's trap function, but we really want to run the guest OS's because on real hardware where there's no hypervisor, that's what would happen. So what we're going to do in that case is we're going to say, oh, we're in user mode. Let's mark ourselves as in pretend kernel mode. So this is pretend kernel mode. And set up our stack pointer and our trap handler as if we had an exception happen. So this is, again, emulating what the real hardware would do. So if the real hardware was in user mode, it would just run the guest OS's kernel. That's what we're going to do on its behalf. Okay, so questions on this idea? Okay, so I've talked about how we handle things like I/O and the protection faults around it, and also how we handle, like, what if, you know, we have a protection fault in a user program. And a protection fault in a user program seems awfully like a weird special case, but I'm mentioning it because these same principles are how we're going to handle a much more common case of system calls. And system calls are kind of like a special case of a privilege instruction where no matter what the mode is, what do we want to do? Execute the guest OS's system call handler, because that's what would happen on the real hardware. When we make a system call, it runs that system call handler. And we also have the issue of returning from a system call. How does that work? Well, that's a privileged operation because return from exception, you know, changes from kernel to user mode. We can't do that in user mode. So we'll emulate that. So let's look at this first part. So we have our guest OS running in its pretend user mode. It makes a system call that triggers the real hardware exception handler in the hypervisor. And the hypervisor is just going to arrange to return into the guest OS's system call handler. And as part of doing this, we need to do a little setup. So we need to remember that we're in fake kernel mode. So later on, if the system call handler tries to do I/O, we know, oh yeah, that's, we should emulate the I/O because the guest OS thinks it's a kernel mode, it's okay. We also are going to need to update the page table, which we'll talk about why later. And then we're going to set up to run the real system call handler. So let's say our system call handler does whatever it needs to do and then returns back to the program. Normally, that would be done with some return from exception operation, which switches from kernel to user mode. But that's not going to work because we're already in user mode on the real hardware. So what's going to happen? Well, you're in user mode. You can't switch back to user mode. You're already there. So we'll get an exception handler for that. And in this exception handler, we'll emulate the operation of returning to user mode. So we'll update the program counter, update the page table, we'll talk about why later, and return back to the user program, just like would happen if we were actually running on real hardware and there was no hypervisor involved, and we ran a normal return from exception instruction. Questions on everything that we do to emulate these system calls. Okay, I am surprised at the level of quiet. So one minor thing I'd like to mention is that sort of, when I gave my example of I/O, we were using this special I/O instruction. And there's some subtlety with dealing with memory mapped I/O. And the big subtlety is that if we try to access device memory that we're not supposed to, we'll get a page fault. But no, there's actually going to be two types of page fault for our hypervisor. So one type is it's trying to act, the guest OS is trying to access a device. Another type is that the guest OS is trying to do an access outside of its page table. For example, maybe we have allocate on demand implemented in the guest OS. In that case, we're going to choose between either emulating some hardware that would implement that memory or running the exception handler in the guest OS, just like would have happened on real hardware if you had a bad access to memory. That's a subtlety with, you know, these cases, is that, you know, we might have to do extra work to figure out, is this an exception to give to the guest OS or something we're emulating? Okay. So we've talked about this sort of trap and emulate approach. I call it trap and emulate because we get an exception, a trap for what the guest OS is trying to do, and we pretend it does what it would do on the real hardware. So I have an exercise here. So let's say we're running a user program. It makes a write system call to write four characters to the screen. The implementation writes a character at a time to a memory mapped IO address to implement this. My question is, how many exceptions occur on the real hardware? I'll give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so we're kind of split here. Let me count how I would count. So we make a system call. The system call is a real system call on the real hardware, but the hypervisor in PostOS is going to interpret that specially to invoke the guest OS's system call handler. So that's one exception. Each of these writes, you know, so note is going to be another exception because we have to emulate it. So you're going to emulate the IO device. And we note that so some of you might have had the idea, well, we could expose the real memory location to the guest OS, but remember that we're, you know, probably actually outputting differently, a different way. You know, e.g., we're displaying in a window. So it's extremely likely that we're, you know, in addition to probably not being comfortable giving the guest OS direct access to the hardware, that probably we need to do some translation where the guest OS is going to be writing to this memory mapped IO address, but we want to do something more complicated to actually output the thing. because, you know, we're not directly outputting to the screen, we're outputting to like a window or an SSH connection or something else, which works differently. Now, there's something that wasn't mentioned very explicitly, and I would count six because we need to return from the system call. And you mentioned that that's going to be a switch from kernel to user mode operation, and that's not going to work in the fake kernel mode, so that's going to trigger a sixth exception. So I counted six. I understand if you omitted this last one, and, you know, I think, hope you really understand why I think it's, you know, we're going to have to assume most likely that even though maybe technically in some really special cases, you could avoid having exceptions for these memory mapped IO, we're probably going to have to emulate those operations in order to translate from what the guest OS is trying to do to what works on our real hardware. Questions about my reasoning for this question? Okay, so this is the trap and emulate approach I've shown you so far. And this seems like a nice, reasonable way of implementing virtual machines, you know, but it has an assumption, which is unfortunately not always true. And the assumption is that any operation for anything which the hypervisor might want to change. That any operation where the hypervisor wants to change how it works, it can cause a fault of some sort of trap. And this is mostly the case, but sometimes architectures like x86 haven't thought very carefully about how their operations work. And there were some operations which behave differently in kernel and user mode, but not in a way which caused an exception. And this was a reason why you would have to do something more complicated. Happily, more recent architectures tend to be, you know, cleaner in this respect. And some older architectures are also cleaner in this respect. x86 is just pretty messy. And modern processor manufacturers have gone beyond just making sure that you can do this trap and emulate approach and often provided some extra hardware support to help make doing the trap and emulate approach easier. Okay. So our last topic, as I previewed earlier, is going to be how we handle the other big important part of executing our virtual machines, which is handling memory. And we need to think about how do we implement page tables? So the guest OS is going to send a page table. How do we make that work on the real hardware? And we don't want to just expose the real memory as is to the guest OS. We want to do some sort of, you know, translation. We want to set aside part of the memory at different addresses. So how do we make that happen? And to talk about this, I'm going to need to talk about different types of addresses. So I have some terms. So I'm going to use the term virtual address to refer to a virtual address that the guest OS thinks it has. I'm going to use the term physical address to refer to a physical address the guest OS thinks it has. This is not on the real hardware. I'm going to use the term machine address to refer to a physical address on the real hardware, the actual address in the real hardware. This is just so I don't have to use for the all the time when I'm talking about this. So given that, here's sort of what we want to do, that we have our guest OS is running, it has a page table, it thinks it's set, that translates from virtual to physical, but the physical address is not for the real hardware, it's for the fake hardware, and the hypervisor has some mapping from the physical address to actual real hardware addresses. And we want to do this two-step translation. So the guest OS has set a page table, and we want to further translate that guest OS's page table to the actual machine addresses. And we need to tell the hardware, hey, when the guest OS is running, it's trying to access this virtual address, here's the address to really access. So we need to give the hardware this mapping. And the hardware, how do we give the hardware this information? Well, the mechanism we know about that doesn't involve special hardware support is that if we want the hardware to do this translation when the guest OS is running with virtual addresses, we have to give it a page table that does this translation. And we're going to call this page table the shadow page table. You might say, "What? Why shadow?" We can think of it as kind of the shadow cast by the guest page table. And to construct this page table, we can have the hypervisor sort of combine the guest page table and its page table into to give something the hardware can handle. And the hardware, so when it's running, it's just going to know about this shadow page table. The guest OS, it doesn't know it's running in a virtual machine. It's running the same code that would run outside a virtual machine. So it's only going to know about this page table. And so our key operation is that we're going to have to do this translation. So the hypervisor is going to have to produce this page table so the hardware can have its do its translation, because this is the only way we can tell the hardware, hey, when the guest OS is running, here are the addresses to use. And it has to be constructed from the guest's page table, so we match the guest expectation for how its memory works. So constructing that page table is fairly straightforward. We do two page table lookups to construct it and synthesize it. But the tricky question is, when do we do this? Like, when do we update the page table? And there's some obvious cases where it might make sense. You might say, okay, well, the guest OS sets this with the privileged instruction, so let's set it then. But then we have a problem that, well, if we did this translation once, what if the guest OS changes something in its page table? We need to make that change something in the real hardware, don't we? And to think about how we can handle that situation, I'm going to talk a bit about how page table updates work on real hardware. And this is going to be important because it's going to give us a nice shortcut. And on real hardware, we have to worry about the TLB. So the TLB, as you may or may not have learned in a prior class, is a cache for page table entries. And if you remember, when we were talking about our paging assignment, you have to do something which flush the TLB. So normally, the processor actually uses the TLB to do address translation and not the page tables. And the processor has this problem that sometimes the page tables get updated and the TLB is different now because the page tables were updated. And the solution that the processor has for this is that the OS better tell you, hey, I updated the page tables by doing that flush TLB operation. And we're going to take advantage of this in our hypervisor solution for setting up that shadow page table. And we're going to see that the shadow page table, we can kind of think of like a virtual TLB. So let's look at how the TLB works. So normally, on real hardware, you know, our OS is running, some code is running, it asks for an address, and that goes to the TLB, which is, remember, a cache. So if the address it's asking for isn't in the TLB, the processor fetches entry on demand and fills in the TLB. And we can copy this strategy for our hypervisor. So for our hypervisor, we're going to say, we're going to have this be kind of like our shadow page table that's actually used for the accesses. And this is kind of our guest plus hypervisor page tables. So we're going to use the same kind of solution where we're going to use this same technique that real processors use to fill their TLB from the source of truth, the page table, to fill the shadow page table from the source of truth, that combination of the guest page table and the real page table. But but we're going to do it on page fault rather than just a TLB entry missing. Now, let's think about the case where our source of truth, in the case with the real hardware, our page table is updated. What happens there is the OS sets a page table entry, and the way the hardware works is the hardware has made a choice to make implementing the TLB simpler to not automatically sync the update to the TLB. Yes, the hardware could probably have figured out a way to do that, but they didn't. And we can take advantage of this, this later on, as we'll see. Because the hardware made this choice, there's more work for the OS, which sets this page table entry, in that it needs to explicitly invalidate at least part of this TLB. And we run a special instruction in the paging assignment, you ran this LCR3 thing in order to tell the hardware, hey, your TLB's wrong. And this means that the guest OS running on real hardware is going to run this special instruction to tell the hardware, hey, I updated a page table entry. And the purpose of that is to handle this structure produced from the page table. And we can use that special instruction in a hypervisor for the same kind of purpose. It's not the TLB anymore, but the hypervisor, you know, we know that when the guest OS is running, it's going to think there's a TLB that it needs to worry about, and it's going to run an instruction to fix that up. That's a privileged instruction, hopefully. So the hypervisor can clear out the shadow page table and also maybe run a real TLB and not a TLB fixing instruction on its behalf at that time. So in this model, you can kind of think of our shadow page table as kind of like a virtual TLB, and we're managing it the same kind of way the hardware would manage a TLB, that we're gonna fill it in as we need to by looking at the real mapping. And the guest OS is gonna tell us when it makes a change to its part of the real mapping, so we don't have to monitor the guest page tables for updates. And this is sort of one way we can implement the shadow page table and handle updating it. We can just do this on demand, so we can, it's like a cache of these full translations. We fill it in as we need to. How do we know when we need to? Well, we're going to get a page fault because we haven't filled in the shadow page table yet. And when there's a TLB changing instruction, we translate that into a virtual TLB changing instruction. And in order for this approach to work, we just rely on the ways for invalidating the TLB to actually be privileged instructions. And in x86, happily they are. There's one instruction, the one used in the assignment, sets a new page table base pointer, even if it's the same address, that as a rule that invalidates the TLB. There's also a pinpoint invalidation instruction, but these are both hopefully privileged, so we can do this strategy where the hypervisor gets to run and fix up its virtual TLB rather than having the real hardware fix up the real TLB. So questions about this view of the shadow page table? Now, one complicating thing about the shadow page table idea is that there's some page table features we need to implement that are going to make this a little tricky. And one of them is the idea of kernel-only pages. You know, that's something we're going to have on all our guest OS. And this means we need the real page table, the shadow page table, to behave differently depending on whether we're in the pretend kernel mode or the pretend user mode. In the pretend kernel mode, we want kernel-only pages to be accessible in user mode. In the shadow page table, why? Because the guest OS, even though it thinks it's in kernel mode, is really in user mode. When the guest OS is in pretend user mode, we want those entries to be inaccessible. And you might say, gosh, how can we do that with one page table? Well, one solution is that we don't have one page table. We have two shadow page tables, and we switch between them depending on whether we're in pretend kernel mode or pretend user mode. So this is, yes, a bunch of extra overhead, but at least this solves the problem, and we didn't need any extra hardware supports. An alternative solution, which is also ugly and seems to have a lot of overhead, is that we could clear the page table on a kernel to user switch and like reconstruct it and pay attention to whether we're in pretend kernel mode as we do that. But in either case, you know, we're going to have to do something to handle this difference of having different types of page table entries depending on whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode or not. Questions on this idea of why we would need separate shadow page tables for these two cases? So all of this gives us things, the idea that I have an approach for implementing virtual machines that, assuming that things actually cause exceptions, doesn't require any special hardware support, but I paid a pretty big cost. I have these extra page tables, this extra setting of page tables. So with that in mind, let's think about one sort of case for overhead. And this is, with this scenario, we have a guest program in the guest OS makes a read system call. The guest OS switches to another program because it's not ready for that, gets an interrupt from the keyboard, switches back, returns from the read system call. So to do this with remember we're in a hypervisor, first, how many times does the guest page table change? So this is how many times does the guest thinks it's changing its page table? And how many real page table changes or clearing are we going to need to do to implement this in our hypervisor? Because remember, we have that shadow page table that the hardware actually uses. So how many of those are we going to need? And remember, when thinking about this, that idea that we needed to have our page tables be set up differently for pretend user versus pretend kernel mode. And you are seeing a poll, right? Yes, okay. At least one person is. Give another 15 seconds. Okay, so I don't understand where 3 comes from for guest page table switches. So if this was running on real hardware, remember the guest page table, guest is running the same code it would on real hardware. So the guest page table is as if it were on real hardware. then I count switch to another program, switch back. Remember, when handling this interrupt, we can use the same page table as the other program to do that. And we don't need to change page tables to go from user to kernel mode, because if we have an XV6-like OS at least, maybe some others would work differently, we have the kernel loaded into every process in the same place, so there's no reason to switch otherwise. This is about page table changes, not like exceptions and so on. So as for our shadow page table, remember the key thing is that we need different PTEs for the kernel memory. Memory, kernel only for, fake kernel only memory. By fake, I mean the guest kernel's memory is marked as kernel only in its guest page table. In the shadow page table, we need to have one version for if it's in pretend kernel mode where that's accessible and one where it isn't. And this means when we make the system call, we have for the user to kernel switch, we need to change from one shadow page table to another or somehow reset all that kernel memory to be accessible again when it previously wasn't. Maybe conceptually we could avoid resetting. Another for the real page table switch that the guest does. One for the interrupt for from user to kernel. So two other program. Three for return to user mode another program. Because remember, when we switch, we're switching in kernel mode. And then four for switching to kernel to handle the interrupt. And then five for switching to the other program, and six for returning to user mode. So I count six. Maybe you could avoid some of these where you observe when you're going from user to kernel, you're just filling in extra entries, but I'm assuming we maintain separate tables for user and kernel. So questions about my reasoning there? I see most people disagreed, and I know I'm over time, but yes, just a note for next time I'll do my last time for what we talked about today, and then we'll do exam review. So if you don't have questions, I'm not going to talk very much. So please come with questions you'd like me to talk about. Okay, so I think that's all I have, since I don't see any questions apparently. See you next week.